This is the last day, as you all are aware. Just to put it in a context of reflecting on the perception of separating, of leaving, of the end of the Leicester Summer School 2004, I like to use this as a way of, you know, to be aware of the state of mind. Like in the beginning, the first day, the first evening, there's this sense of something happening, and there's time, there's, you know, we expect to be here for 6 days, and that's a different feeling, the feeling that one has now of it's over, and then the inevitable separation of leaving. And so this is a exercise in reflecting on the way it is. It's the simple experiences of our life, of meeting and separating. And this is it's not making any value judgments or statements about it, just recognizing the reality of this moment with this sense. The conditions now have arisen for separating, and it's like this. So the separation is still in the future. You know, it's 12 noon. And so the future is still, you know, is not a memory. So we can remember previous summer schools, just to learn to trust your own awareness in recognizing the conditions that exist at this moment, this sense of the end of something that began on Monday and ending on Saturday, the actual physical separation only a couple of hours away. And this is the way it is, because this the one's life is a continuous experience of meeting and separating. When you think of your life, you know, from birth to death, is this continuous process of coming together, separating, starting, finishing, and this is. Because of this realm that we live in, the sense realm, is impermanent, and every beginning has an ending. So beginning is the potential, the possibility, and then the ending is we remember what we've been experiencing, people we've met, what we've done during these past 5 days. And then the future is no longer connected to the summer school, is it? It's going home, going back to the monastery. Tomorrow I have to give a talk in the afternoon. So this is like an intuitive sense, and with awareness, it's we're not trying to, you know, make it. We tend to mix our awareness with wanting to define it or qualify it or compare it with something, and so we're never fully appreciative or really tuned in to the reality of life that we're experiencing. So the ending's so easy to start planning our next move and not really notice, not be fully with the experience of ending and separating. And you can see this is the samsaric tendency of attachment. Like every time, you know, when you become bored with something, you don't you don't observe boredom, unless you're practicing mindfulness. As soon as you feel bored, you seek some distraction, something interesting or exciting, or at least distracting you away from the boredom with the present moment. And so, you know, life is searching for rebirth in this way, a continuous sense of being reborn again into some new thing, something like something that's interesting. We're interested in it. We have tried to sustain an interest, you know, for a long period of time, and inevitably you become bored with even the most interesting condition or experience. Too much pleasure becomes boring. If you live an exciting life with a lot of you know, adventures and romance and excitement and pleasure, after a while you become bored with that. And then I just want to go off to the mountaintop and be alone. And you go to the mountaintop and you're there only a few minutes. And then you start planning how to get back down. Then the next thing you think you want to be doing. So this is like rebirth in terms of the rebirth that we can actually contemplate in our lives. In how they use the word rebirth, doesn't necessarily mean physical rebirth, you know, being born again in the next life, but it's the mental rebirth that we experience that are so ordinary to us, we don't notice. We're just involved in the next rebirth as soon as life becomes boring or unpleasant, seek rebirth in something else. So that means like beginning again something, choosing something that you have this sense of arising, of beginning. It's interesting. It has potentiality for fulfillment, for happiness, for whatever, you know, that you imagine, for entertainment, for just being totally kind of mesmerized and taken over by something. Like in the movies, you know, they're usually the pop movies around sex and violence, because these are very overwhelming, kind of exciting energies. Sexuality and physical violence, war, conflict, and that it excites the mind. You don't have to concentrate on it. It holds your attention. So there's nothing wrong, I'm not complaining or condemning this, but just noticing that, you know, the exciting ability to excite the mind, where so much of life, you know, isn't exciting. It's just this moment, nothing much happening. And so if we're not aware, we tend to want to fill our moments with things, with plans, with the possibilities, with distractions, with eating, with drinking, with television, because peacefulness, calm, emptiness, stillness is, we can't stand it actually. It's too hard to bear. So like concentration practices are, you know, most meditation techniques are for concentrating the mind, because the mind wanders and we tend to wander away, you know, planning the future or remembering the past. So concentration exercises are training the mind to stay with an object and absorb into it. Like when you absorb into something, you actually become one with it. The sense of separateness falls away. So So if you, you know, when you, if you do color kathina meditations, you know, you become that color, actually, through absorbing into it. And so I did one years ago on the color green, and green, I began to see green everything, you know, it became, where even when I wasn't concentrating, I noticed green everywhere, more than I would ever do. And then I could, you know, green kind of seemed to be, you know, was what I had kind of absorbed into, and then the result of that was a heightened sense of greenness, which is, you know, beautiful color. At least the green that I concentrated on. I don't like these kind of murky, dirty greens. It's beautiful green, you know, excellent. In, say, in jhana factors, you know, the vidakkha, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata, then these are the factors to develop in concentration. So vidakkha, vichara is taking the subject, and it can be very reflective, and so it becomes firmly set, and then by concentrating on the object, then you experience this piti or rapture, a sense of physical oneness with it. It's a kind of pleasure, physical pleasure, then mental happiness, and then one-pointedness, ekagata. So these are kind of like meditation exercises. You know, when we use attainments, attainment doesn't really work because they are relinquishments. You know, like in the jhanas, you begin to recognize how to let go of the coarser factor until there's nothing left but equanimity or ekagata. So it's not, rather than trying to get rapture and happiness through conceiving it and then trying to aim for it, you let go of the desire to achieve it or imagine it and try to attain it towards an increasing sense of surrender and relinquishment to the object of concentration. But like any form, it's limited. So, and conditions that support, say, tranquility and refined levels of consciousness are very limited also. The world we live in is not a tranquil realm, it's a sense realm. So this realm is like this, it's full of stimulation, of irritation. The senses are constantly being impinged on from birth to death. And that impingement, even its pleasurable impingement, when you look at it, is a kind of irritation of the senses, contacting and stimulating. So even sensory experience at its best is, you know, when seen from emptiness, is another. It's irritating. It has this sense of being inadequate. Say, when we apply the word meditation, and of course that includes almost everything, that, you know, any kind of mental training that you can think of. It's a term used for everything. But the samatha practices, of course, are concentration practices, where you choose an object and focus on that. Then the vipassana, a lot of vipassana techniques easily end up being concentration practices, because the technique tends to dominate. You know, we absorb into a technique rather than use a technique for awareness. And so this is why during this week, pointing out that this sense of trusting yourself intuitively to recognize just a natural state of awareness, you know, that is, that you can't get it in terms of, you can't see it, but you can know it. It's a knowing. It's this way. And so awareness is formless. And this, I think, is what we find difficult to accept, because there's so much in, you know, our whole conditioning process is to seek rebirth in form, to attach to some form, to become something. So that this ultimate freedom of formlessness, no boundary, emotionally, is quite frightening at first. One can be quite terrified of it, because all the forms, the boundaries, identities fall apart, and you think, you know, and your emotional habits can't cope with it. It doesn't. Your emotions don't know what's happening, and it looks like you're having a breakdown. You're losing your mind. You don't know who you are, and these are frightening for us. I've met people who didn't have a very good self-image of themselves, but they knew who they were. You know, I'm a Buddhist, or I'm a Theravadan, or people will take on, you know, the you meet gay people, the first thing they say is, I'm gay. And that's why they present themselves. Or Jewish, or whatever. And this then is you know, there's some identity that makes them, gives them a sense of security, of knowing who they are. When those identities go, then what am I? And this of course, what I'm pointing out is emotional habits. Our emotions are conditioned around becoming things, about extremity, about happiness and suffering. So emotional habits usually, you know, are when we reach this point of emptiness, or we get near it, emotionally it can be very frightening, because then we tend to seek, you know, to get away from it, to find a place to that we can feel, well, I know what I am now. I know who I am. So not knowing who you are, this sense of not knowing in with awareness doesn't mean state of stupidity and but it means it's centering in the knowing of consciousness, knowing the way it is. So it's not a judging, critical factor. It doesn't seek to evaluate or criticize or prefer, but it's the direct knowing of the way it is. And in terms of the Vipassana terms are always, you know, the conditioned phenomena is impermanent. Now I find that with a lot of way Vipassana is taught, people grasp these ideas of all conditions are impermanent, and they become obsessed with it. So, and in some ways it's like an intellectual projection. I've heard people say, well, everything is impermanent, like it's not worth grasping anything because it's all impermanent, it's all going to disappoint me. You know, it's a kind of wet blanket approach. You know, everything is going to, I'm going to fail, and everything, I'm going to die anyway. So what's everything is impermanent. And this is not Vipassana. The word Vipassana really, you know, literally means insight into the nature of things. Or probably they've yoniso manasikara, which is getting to the very root, the causes of things. So it's a direct knowing, of not a knowing about. It's not a function of thinking, but of trusting intelligence, which is a universal. You know, it's not a personal thing. It's intelligence. It's not cultivated in the sense that you have to, you know, increase your intelligence, it's learning to recognize and appreciate this simple ability, the natural ability that we all have, that potential for enlightenment, for seeing in this clear way, without attachment to anything whatsoever. So I found, you know, like I just noticing, like reflections on space, just using space as a reflection, gave me the insight into infinity. Where before that, I knew what infinity meant, but it was just an abstract word. No, and it was defined, not recognized. So I'm not making a statement like a scientist that. About infinity, but just recognizing at this moment the reality of space. It has no boundary. It's infinite. And I'm not making, you know, trying to make some kind of philosophy about that, but we have to trust within the boundaries we find ourselves, like this physical body, this consciousness, this conscious experience right now from where I'm sitting. As I open to just the space, starting the space in the room, but then you realize it has no boundary. The walls make it look like a boundary, but the walls are in space. This infinity, then infinite space, is reality in this moment. When I contemplate that, I'm not dismissing the conditions that are in front of me. I don't have to shut you out, because infinite space can receive everything, all forms, all conditions. It doesn't hide the spaciousness of this moment. Or then consciousness itself, like how I used to regard consciousness, was usually about the brain. It's in my, you know, the idea was that my brain is conscious. And so it's in my head. But then in reflective meditation, consciousness isn't something that I can say is in my brain. It seems to be everywhere. The fact that you're in my, you know, I can actually see you at this moment. You're in my mind. You're in my consciousness. Consciousness holds you at this moment, because that's the way it is. But you're not in my brain. At least I don't think so. So these are quite obvious, you know, but they're so obvious that we often we don't notice. What's most simple and most real can be overlooked because of our movement always towards extremity, towards certainty, wanting something that doesn't exist right now, aiming to get something we don't have yet, something we imagine would be wonderful to have, but we don't have it now. Or if we look down and we think, oh, all this is obstructing me, wanting to get rid of this moment because I've got this view that all this is an obstruction to my peacefulness or my enlightenment. The reality of space and consciousness is here and now. It's a fact, you know. And to use that more for reflection, to notice it, to pay attention to it, because then you have perspective on through consciousness on the forms, the conditions that arise and cease throughout your life. You know, the thoughts, the emotions, the sense of yourself as a person, love and hate. Greed, hatred, and delusion, fear, pleasure, and pain. to define infinity is impossible. Because language itself is an infinite, you know. It's form. So this is why I pointed to emphasizing this trusting in your awareness, because that's before you learn to speak or before thoughts arise. Awareness is always present, always here and now. Consciousness always here and now. Then deathlessness, that is that's another term. What is death then? Right now, for all of us, is what hasn't happened yet. We haven't died. So it's a concept, isn't it? Like we think of Catherine Hewitt now. You know, last year she was sitting here, right over there. and so Catherine Hewitt is here and she's alive. Now the perception Catherine Hewitt is dead. It's different, isn't it? It's a different feeling to it. Because death is what we don't know. We haven't experienced it. Physical death. So in terms of physical death, this is, you know, we would like to know what happens when you die. And then the various scenarios of reincarnation or heaven, hell, or oblivion or one can prefer these various options and go along with what the Buddhists say or the Hindus or the Christians or whatever. But the reality is, at least from this position right here, I don't know. But I'm confident that my body will die. And so I'm not trying to make my body immortal and make it, trying to make it a deathless form, because that's not possible. So then deathlessness, is that just a wish in the mind, immortality? Is that because we're afraid of death? Or is that reality? And so then, like Nibbana, what they call Amata Dhamma, the deathless reality. Amaravati is a deathless realm. The Buddha was pointing to deathlessness as liberation, not some kind of perfect state or form state. And so then, if we explore the beginning and ending, the birth and death of conditions as we experience it before the body dies, we have the insight into what arises ceases. And conditions arise according to other conditions. They just, when the sun shines, then it's like this. When it's rainy, it's like this. When conditions for happiness are present, then I feel happy. Conditions for sadness, then I sadness. Conditions for when I feel secure and safe as a person, conditions for that, everything's going well and there's no kind of threatening warning signs around me, I feel secure as a person. And then as soon as the threatening signs occur, then I feel insecure. So the conditioned realm is like this. It's all about birth and death, beginning and ending. That's its very nature. And the sense of a self is a condition. The sakyaditti is conditioned. So it arises and ceases and changes according to conditions. So that in Vipassana meditation, the reflecting on conditionality, getting to recognize conditionality, is like this. So, what is the flavor of the world? What does the world taste like? And so then I try, the mind will start to try to make it into some complicated, maybe even poetic form. But the flavor of the world to me is it's always, you know, it's unstable. It's there's always this sense of something missing, of incompleteness, of unsatisfactoriness, even at its best, even when everything is just fine, with good health and everything's going just the way we want. It's still, you know, this fluttery experience. So people, you know, that I know who have been very fortunate in their lives have a lot of fear also, because they know it will change. You can't sustain security and all the best conditions, because and we know that. We know that we can't hold on, even though we try to. The more we try to hold on and control, the more miserable we become. And the very act of grasping out of not knowing is itself a very unpleasant state of mind that we create. So we can't even enjoy beauty. We tend to suffer even with beauty because we want to hold it and keep it. And that very grasping destroys it. And the way one can actually notice this is just observing how you hold things, you know, the way you are. Not as a criticism, but just as a way of reflecting, awakening to the way it is, to the Dhamma. Then deathlessness is our true nature. You know, it's not as a person. My personality is born and gets born and dies all the time. I've never tried to. You know, I used to think, what in my personality would I want to live with forever? And I couldn't find anything. And the idea of me being a unique soul that will last forever, what is in my soul, that the soul that is unique to me as a person, that I would want to be eternal and never die? And I couldn't think of anything. nothing I could imagine. I'd want to have this sense of me as a unique person, as a unique soul, then, rather than a person. Then it goes up a grade into being a unique soul. That's always me. So when we're all dead, and you say, "Oh, that's Ajahn Sumedho." I'm a soul now. I'm glad you recognize me. Well, what if we all had to live here in this beautiful garden forever with each other? With no option of getting out of it. All good people, beautiful place, but yeah. If we were permanently what we are on the conditioned plane, you know, we'd still have this anxiety, this waveringness, this insecurity, because that's a result of absorption into conditioned phenomena, or identification with it. So then the only way to resolve that problem is to understand it, to know it, to awaken to it. And that awakening is Buddha. It's not Buddhism. You know, in the sense of, it's not, you know, something that about being a Buddhist or knowing all about Buddhism, but it's actually the reality of Buddha, of awakenness. Try to imagine deathlessness. And all you can get is some kind of immortal fantasy, you know, and a heavenly fantasy where everything's beautiful and you're young forever and there's no disease. And it's like a childlike fantasy of paradise. But as you trust the awareness more, then you can also, the formless, the unbounded, isn't a state of kind of void, kind of unconscious annihilation, but it's where that ignorant grasping is no longer your obsession. So in this miracle that we're all experiencing right now is from this emptiness the forms arise and cease. So it is like a miracle, and that's just the way it is. It's not, we're not trying to seek annihilation so that all the forms are die and they never, and there's no, never any form arising ever again. And that's the desire for annihilation. Extinction, you know, it's a kind of desire, we call vipavadanha, a desire for annihilation, for getting rid of. And that, of course, is, you know, sometimes when we're fed up with ourselves in the world, we would like to just annihilate ourselves, kill ourselves, just become nothing, disappear into a void. And that's another wish, that's another desire that we create. And so suicide or things like this is not the answer. It's I mean, it's just, you just get reborn again because that's the nature of desire. But every moment within our lifespan is, as we recognize and trust and learn to really appreciate this awareness, then you see that is really joy comes from that, compassion, love, but it's not personal. It's not based on liking or on preference or on karmic attachments. The Dhamma isn't just a destruction of conditioned phenomena, but a container for it, where all possibilities, all of conditioned phenomena can arise and cease, and nothing, there's nothing that can bind us once we see that, because the reality is the Dhamma rather than the forms that arise and cease. So in say Satipatthana reflections, it's these are skillful means the Buddha developed to investigate experience, to break down the illusions we hold, to break through the ignorance that we grasp at, to free ourselves from the formed, the limited, the unsatisfactory. I see now how, rather than teaching too many techniques or give too much structure, it's the encouragement is to trust yourself with awareness. Because So many times, when we're teaching Buddhism or teaching meditation techniques, it's coming from a sense of attainment, of having to get something you don't have, and or get rid of your defilements. And so there's so much a sense, it just increases a sense of I'm somebody who, you know, has to become something that I'm not. I have to get rid of my bad traits, my faults, my defilement. And if you never see through that, then it's a hopeless task. The best you can do is maybe modify your habit tendencies. And you can make yourself maybe a nicer person and be more happy in the world. But and that's not to be despised either. But the point of the Buddhist teaching is the liberation, like in the sequence of Dana Sila. That helps to make you to create more happiness in the world, self respect, good relations with the people you're living with the society you're in. It gives you positive sense of and positive attitude towards the world around you, towards yourself, which also has good results. You know, positive people that are quite positive and happy are very attractive. People like you, and you tend to, be more successful in life, and have more friends and more worldly happiness, just by being good and happy. And by being miserable and bad, then you create the opposite. You know, nobody likes you, and you have live in a world of fear and resentment. So that's just noticing. Just that's how it is. You know, like happy thoughts, good thoughts make me feel good. Like positive thinking, power of positive thinking. It does, it uplifts me, it inspires me, it makes me happy. And when I'm happy, I'm a lot easier to be with. And when I think negatively, I think of what's wrong with me and you and the world, and then when I meet people, you know, I start grumbling, complaining, and then I start making them unhappy. And this observation, like karma, the word karma, is oftentimes it's assumed in the Western mind as a kind of fate. My karma, and as if it's a kind of my fate, my destiny. But the word actually is for cause and effect. It's action. And so the simple, do good, refrain from doing bad. Good karma is doing good. And then you receive a good result. Bad karma, then you receive that kind of result. So if I harm and lie and steal and disrespect people, and then the result is the bad karma is the result of that is fear and people hating me and resenting me and feeling, you know, very negative. I live in a hell realm of negativity. Then there's the power of positive thinking cults, where just think happy and you'll be happy. And of course there's something in us that sees the kind of silliness of that. It's, it looks very, very cosmetic, superficial, unreal. Just to suppress negativity or suppress fear by obsessing your mind with positive thoughts. Now, if you know what you're doing, then that's fine. Like mantras and mala beads and chants and all these are very skillful means. Because not if you're just using them to suppress fear and anger, but because they do. They have a good effect on the mind. The calming effect on the mind. Reflecting on the Buddha Dhamma Sangha and gratitude toward the Buddha. Like I've had a lot of gratitude towards the Buddha and towards Ajahn Chah. The sense of I've been given so much wonderful things in my life that there's a sense of real gratitude. Gratitude's a very positive. It gives me, when I recognize this, then something in me just really feels, in a very positive way. I have a stability of reference to just not being caught in resenting and blaming and criticizing everything. Or complaining because I didn't get everything I wanted. And contentment, monasticism itself, like the monastic training, is all about contentment, learning to be content with very little. So we have, you have monastic reflections every day you reflect on the four requisites. You know, what's allowed, the Buddha allowed a bhikkhu was a meal, a robe, a shelter for the night, medicines for illness. This, if you reflect on it over the years, you find this sense of contentment. I'm not spending, you know, I'm not trying to get the best robe with the best shelter or the best food, because you've spent your life reflecting on the food that you, that people offer you. You know, it isn't whether it's your preferred meal, but your contentment is based on the gratitude, the generosity of the act itself, and the shelter, and the medicine when one's ill. So this is very good for someone like myself, brought up in a society where, you know, contentment is despised. You know, you think in America, we think of anyone who's content as being a bit stupid, like a cow, you know, chewing cud. You know, to be discontented, you always, you know, you're progressing. Don't be content with anything except the best. And you can't, even when you've got the best, it doesn't stay that way. You start looking, somebody's got something better, and the best changes. This movement of the mind, you know, the way we can create this endless discontentment with the material world, or the families we're in, or the conditions we're living in, the society we're in. Because we could always imagine it being better than this. So the contentment isn't just an ignoring, you know, kind of deluding yourself, but it comes through this reflecting of, well, I don't really need very much. You know, my needs are very minimal. So I don't have to spend my life just trying to, because if I have high expectations, high standards, then I have to struggle all the time to kind of get that high standard and keep it. That takes a lot of effort. I wouldn't have any time for meditation. So, and then if I suddenly win the lottery, find myself a multi-millionaire, I'd still be programmed for, you know, now what do I do with £100 million? And then I would start suspecting, why are people so nice to me now? And then somebody might take me hostage, and, you know, all kinds of, I mean, who's going to take a Buddhist monk hostage? So they just noticing that like gratitude and contentment are not you can't make yourself grateful or content, but that comes through your own ability to recognize what is important in your life, what is really worthy of giving your attention to, what are your needs really, you know, what do you think you need, or what are you conditioned to feel you must have, and what do you really need, you know, and this way you find that this gives you the freedom to not just be caught in the kind of obsession of trying to get more and more, because that will really blind you. Then the awareness is, and how do you teach awareness? Like awareness techniques and all that kind of. So that's not, you know, you can point to it, like encourage and point, and present situations where people can reflect, where they, and we all need to have more confidence than we generally have. You know, that's why I keep saying, don't trust what you think you are. Don't believe it, you know, because you, what you think you are is not what you are. Whatever you think you are, that's, you're not that. Or believe you are. You're not that. That's just a perception that you might be obsessed with or attached to. But you're not that. So then by keep reminding yourself, because we are, it's so easy to believe that I am, you know, this person. And it seems, you know, real to me. When I'm attached to that perception, it seems like to deny that would be wrong. But it's not a matter of saying I'm not anything, and not adopting some kind of denial of the conditioned, but a recognizing of conditionality, receiving it and letting it be, letting whatever you think you are be what it is, but your relationship to it is of the knower rather than the personality that has arisen. So whatever you think you are, believe yourself to be, is your creation. So you can actually be aware of that. And it's not to criticize it, but it isn't more anything more than a soap bubble, foam on the sea. Has no essence, no core, no substance. So in daily life, like going in monastic life, you do have opportunities for solitude and community life. So the lifestyle itself has those options in it, but still, people get very attached to solitude. You know, I've got to be alone. I can't live in Amaravati. There's too many people there. People are always binding themselves to some kind of idea they have in order to really practice. There's some place, you know, you go to where none of these things will be there that you find irritating you or you feel threatened by them. The truth of the matter is it doesn't matter where you're at or who you're with if you trust your awareness. So that, you know, if the only time you can ever really feel you're mindful is under ideal conditions, you know, off in this nice kuti, and everything is properly arranged and you feel quite safe and secure, and you've got all your wishes fulfilled, then something will come along to ruin it for you. You know, like I caught malaria one year, and I was in this ideal place, and I was thinking, I'm really going to get my samadhi together. And one morning I could hardly get off the floor. You know, I don't know what hit me. I had malaria for a year. I'd had these recurring attacks of this malaria. And I kept thinking, oh, it's ruining my practice. I can't. Malaria, I can't practice with malaria. And Ajahn Chah came to see me and he says, that's your practice, malaria. I never thought of it like that. I thought, I can't practice because I have this, I feel so terrible. So actually I learned a lot from that. You know, I'd learned a lot about the fear and the suffering I created around the disease itself, the symptoms. Actually, when I actually opened to it, I found that the symptoms were bearable. They weren't all that. I mean, they were uncomfortable, you know, but they wasn't anything I couldn't bear. And so I was surprised at that because the personality's condition is, I can't stand it. I can't practice. I don't know. You may die. People goes to your brain. You go crazy. And I've heard people, you know, I've heard of monks losing their mind to get cerebral malaria, and they get taken off to the mental hospital. No possibility for enlightenment. So these are the panic buttons, you know, the worst scenarios that you could imagine. But, you know, fortunately it didn't go to my brain, but it certainly, you know, was an unpleasant experience in terms of physical feeling. But it also had its nice moments, like when the malaria fever breaks, it goes up and it reaches this peak. And then suddenly it breaks, and you have this incredible sense of coolness. It's very pleasant. So even within the experience of malaria, you know, you could see some, you know, the bits of it that were even pleasant on the physical level. The flavor of the world then its flavor is dukkha. Now this isn't meant to be a put-down of the world, but just pointing to this sense of it, the world, that's its nature, it's changing, and birth and death coming together and parting. The world is like this. It's an ongoing experience of coming together and separating, of meeting and parting. And you can even notice how, in language, how we, you know, to say, I've said this many times about, you know, we don't say goodbye forever when we part. We say, see you next summer. See you again. And in every language, they, you know, whatever language it is, it amounts to see you again. See you soon. Let's keep in touch. And that sense of, in the future, we'll meet again. Because the perception of never meeting again is too stark, too hard to bear. Because emotionally, we would like to meet again. We don't want to have a total separation, unless it's somebody you really can't stand. During this year, then, this next year, this reflect on what I've said, and trust yourself too, in your practice more. Don't criticize yourself. Don't believe how your critical mind might be evaluating your ability to practice or how good a Buddhist you are, whatever. You know, because that you can't trust. It will say anything. Usually, it's a criticism about you're not good enough, or you should practice more, or you're not really a good Buddhist, or you could be better, and on and on like this. So this is the conditioned mind, and how we tend to direct these negative states towards ourselves. And that most of us are very self-critical. We aim at the flaw and hold on to that, and make it into an enormous problem for ourselves. See ourselves through the flaw, and so I encourage you not to, you know, to let go of that habit, you know, to recognize it. It is what it is, but don't perpetuate it. Learn to trust in your own goodness and in your awakeness, and see what happens. See what does come. You know, whatever states you might experience. It doesn't matter, because your relationship to them is knowing them rather than identifying with them or judging them. So sometimes in meditation, a lot of negative states do come up that have been suppressed. Well, let's see that as purification rather than you're practicing wrongly. Because there is a lot of commitment to suppression of negativity in our lives, of just denial and rejection and resistance. When you stop resisting and the habitual resistance and rejection, when that lessens, then these states that have been held back will come into consciousness. But see that as purification rather than as something wrong with you. You see, what I'm pointing at is a level of faith or sadha or confidence in your human ability to be awake and aware. And everybody here, you know, there's no exception. It's your true nature. You're just returning, recognizing your true nature. You'll find, you know, you're not what you think you are, and you're not limited by what you think. Maybe every thought, every attachment will give this sense of limitation. So the very fact that you can open to infinity, to space, consciousness, gives you perspective, that frees you from just this endless rebirthing habit of going from one thing to another. So, time to stop. Here, there's got these beautiful trees here. They're really, you get very fond of these trees. Magnificent old trees. Any questions? Yes?
What if you do get cerebral malaria or... basically, yeah, I'm not trying to put a wet blanket at the end of this. The question of this confidence, where is trust in this sort of situation? How do you relate to trust?
If you recognize the awakening and awareness, then the cerebral malaria, no doubt, is a form that arises in that. And, you know, but the reactions, you know, like people can be quite mad sometimes, but maybe, you know, who's to say they're not aware of it? I mean, when the connections go wrong in the nervous system and you can't control it, it's more like a physiological problem, but in terms of awareness, you know, like I've never had, you know, fortunately I didn't have cerebral malaria. I can't speak from experience, but I know just with malaria I did have how easily, you know, how miserable I make myself just through being afraid of it. And if I lost control of my mental faculties, that'd be even more frightening. Mm-hmm. Become a personal level, because, you know, it would just be, you know, just see myself losing control, that fear of losing control. Where if the refuge is in awareness, then it doesn't matter losing control or craziness or that. These are just the karmic conditions that arise and cease. Fortunately, I've not had to deal with that one. But I have had, you know, I've had pretty crazy moments in my consciousness. But because of the awareness, it wasn't, I didn't create fear around it. It's like, it's also humbling. Like I found, you know, there's a kind of conceit that I'm above this, and, you know, how arrogant a human being can be. You know, so we can look down on somebody and who's going through an emotional crisis and broken heart and feeling of depression. We can feel sorry for them, and yet there's a kind of sense that I'm above that. Fortunately, I'm not like them and the poor things. And then when it happens to me, you know what? You know, when I go through an emotional crisis, then it's quite humbling, because it reflects that sense of, you know, I'm not like you, I'm beyond, I'm above it all. And then you find you're not, because life will always present you, you know, challenge you. These illusions of I'm above all this, I'm not like the rest. Be prepared for being slammed somewhere. And that's the only way you can cope, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, sometimes life forces us to do that, because otherwise we just can't cope with anything. When things get on the conditioned plane, get too difficult, too complicated, too unbearable, you know, we what did we do? We run away or get drunk or whatever, or we awaken. And then we find a strength, you know, from that awakenness that we probably never knew we had before. You know, even though your mind is saying, I can't take it, you find you can take it.